podcast.yum.org. And if you are not on our email list and you would like to be on our email list, please sign the sheet for our email list and make sure you're clear so we get the right email. There is no break. And so if you need to go to the bathroom, I think there's a bathroom right out here. The first thing I want to do is honor a board member who is going off the board, Judy Hall, who has been on the board for 4 years.
We will miss her. It's a great board. Anybody want to join? North America. Thank you. See how nice they are and generous and dinners at people's houses?
Okay. You have a great laugh, doesn't she? That's what we'll miss the most. Okay. So, did anybody see on the community bulletin board the, well, it's a little confusing about where we're about to, because our media is very interesting, our social media. So there was, I was going to do a Von Franz film and discussion group this Sunday at my house in Hadley. Since it got all very confusing and whatever, what I would prefer to do is at my house in Hadley, which is very easy to get to, probably 5 to 6 weeks of film and discussion. The Von Franz films, did everybody, who saw the Von Franz films at the beginning? So there are about 20 of them or something like that, so we're going to pick about 5 of them and just have a, see a film, and then it's not about me being an analyst telling you anything about it, it's really about discussing it together. So I'm going to pass around a piece of paper, and if you're interested, please put your name and put your email address so I can email you specifically when and what time in January, probably end of January, February. Okay? Dan, you want to say anything about our web?
Yeah, just to say that our website is westmassyoung.org, and if you want to find our Facebook page, if you go to our website, you can get to it from there, or go to Young Association of Western Mass on Facebook. And we really encourage conversations there, too. So if you hear something interesting at a lecture or you see something on the Internet that is Young-related, please post it on our Facebook page. We encourage that.
Westmassyoung.org
is our website.
And you can find our Facebook page just by typing in Young Association of Western Mass.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm even going to try to go to it. I have no clue about Facebook. Okay. So our next lectures will all be at Seeley Hall. I can't ask who forgot it was here tonight and didn't get here. We'll have to find out later. There are many people who did get here last time. And next year, we hope to stay at Smith, but we will have to pay for the space next year, quite a fair amount of money. So we're hoping that people in the community will help us with that. We do take donations for the lecture, but we are going to have a large extra expense each month. So please, if anybody has some extra money and you'd want to give to a small, charitable, non-profit little organization, we're here. We would like to keep going. We would really like the space because of the lecture feeling and the wonderful, wonderful film stuff we get to do. Okay, so after this, we will have our salon. I'll be there. Chuck, are you going tonight?
I am.
Yeah, and Carol's going tonight, I'm sure. So we'll be walking over. So anybody who wants to go over and have a cup of tea and continue to talk about this interesting subject that we're all totally sick of. we're ready for it to be over, right? Okay. So next month, Thayer Green is going to be talking on, our wonderful Thayer Green is going to be talking on exploring our dreams, deeply personal and yet objective and universal. And there's a flyer here, and what really helps us if you're at a university campus or up in the hill towns, if you could take a flyer and put it up, because that's how, and put it up like the week before. That will really help us get the word out there. Okay, so Thayer's going to introduce our speaker.
I assume if you're here, you've been involved in one way or another in this unusual political process, and you've listened to commentators strategists on MSNBC, on CNN, and perhaps even on Fox News. I've watched all three, and one sees a gradation. I won't describe the name of the gradation, but you see a gradation in the approach. I'm here to introduce Richard Nicoletti, and he's going to be a commentator on the political scene from a viewpoint that you haven't seen on any of those media stations. Greek mythological perspective on our present dilemmas. And I'm looking forward to it very much. He became first publicly recognized as a wide receiver on the Cornell University football team. And he tries to keep forgetting it, and I keep fascinated with how he survived it. After Cornell, he went to Cornell Law School, and then was in the ROTC for 2 years, still doing a certain kind of military law practice. He then was practicing for 2 years in New York City and had the wisdom to move back to New England and practice until the year 2000 in Boston, Massachusetts, at which time he became deeply drawn to and intrigued by Carl Jung, and as is true with many of us Jungians, changed orientation and careers to go into training and become a Jungian analyst. I got to know Richard when he was in the midst of his training. I taught him in a number of classes, and it so happens, since all analysts in training get thoroughly evaluated twice a year, that I was on his particular evaluation committee, and I was delighted that he passed through the various hoops that one has to pass through and has graduated and is now lecturing and practicing, and from all I can see, is delighted with this stage of his life and this career. So I gladly introduce Richard, who is going to discuss the present unpleasantness.
How did me fare? I'm still trying to atone and redeem my football playing days and my practice of law for 37 years. I could also recall, in terms of being outed, a recovering Catholic. Catholicism being a special institution with a special form of patriarchy, which the Pope recently professed that will continue without women priests for the foreseeable future.
Can you hear? Can everybody hear?
Yeah.
Okay, good. See, I didn't mention, and I won't say exactly either, how many years I did spend in training. That would be the ultimate outing, for which I'm not willing to do right now. My plan this evening is to talk for maybe a half hour. We'll see how it works out. After about 10 minutes, I will have a set of questions, a set of quotes, which is my attempt to be a playful way to determine how much tuned you are and I am to patriarchy in general, and then go on to talk about ultimately what I consider to be the three primary candidates we had during the campaign season, and Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, of course, are the two, and Donald Trump, stood out ultimately from all the Republicans, 15 or 16 of them, and I hope to associate each of the three I've identified with particular characters, as they have said, in Greek mythology, which I hope will prove interesting, if not illuminating. I'm not sure in what way it would be illuminating to cause anybody to change their vote. I'm sure it won't, but it may be a factor, and at least it will be for me, I guess, just to be able to talk about it, to give me some sense of acceptance before we go into Tuesday's actual voting, or the conclusion of the voting, which we all know started in some states some weeks ago. So I'm not sure. I'm going to be reading from down here, so you'll have to excuse me going back and forth to my paper. I'm not sure which system, the papacy or football, especially NFL football, is a better poster child for patriarchy. Each has its own problems with dominative men. Since we know misogyny lives in a patriarchal society, let me try, before I go any further, to say what I mean and mean what I say about patriarchy. I'll try to put patriarchy into context. My simple definition is a political and economic society or system in which men dominate and obviously primarily have the power. I don't want to examine how change is occurring, especially in the economic system, because I've read recently, you probably have too, as of last year, more than half the wealth, the net worth of the country is in the hands of women. Now, whether that is from surviving their husbands or actually doing much better accumulating wealth on the stock market or in real estate or whatever, it doesn't make any difference. The fact is, at least with respect to finances and economic, the women have surpassed us men. In the political system, obviously that's not true, at least in terms of the U.S. Congress. About 20% of women in each of the House of Representatives and the Senate, 20% of the Congress is women. In each house. So there is a way to go, and I expect if Hillary Clinton wins the election this Tuesday, that percentage of women in Congress will grow. We'll see. So we're talking about power, and by power I mean agency, the ability to choose in any context. For example, the ability to choose to run for the presidency of the United States, to break the glass ceiling of patriarchy that under its radar patriarchy denies. But when you come right down to it, in my view, patriarchy most basically is a psychological issue, a state of mind, a worldview or an attitude of men in Jung's sense of readiness or predisposition to act or even to think in a certain way. In this sense, it is mostly unconscious. I'm not sure how many men would readily admit that they're living in a patriarchal society and have special privileges or position according to somebody's state of mind. So my goal to continue the outing vein is to out patriarchy some more. My view says that patriarchy is based on two fears, basically. The first is gendered men's fear and envy of women, that at its worst is misogyny. And we've heard somewhat about misogyny appropriately during this campaign. One example of a comment, Planned Parenthood said recently, tongue-in-cheek, about Trump's campaign slogan, they suggest what it really means is make misogyny great again. That's Planned Parenthood. A more subtle reference to misogyny was uttered by Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, at least insofar as he was reported in a recent issue of New Yorker magazine, October 13, I believe. Maybe you will believe this. He said, Hillary Clinton wants to strip away all joy and color from life. I think that's some indication of the patriarchal attitude. The second fear, I mean, aside from fear and envy of women, which I find it's somewhat difficult to utter out loud, but I feel I must, and that is men are afraid of other men. It is a fact. They're afraid of men's physical strength, other men's sexual potency and related to theirs, fear of being sexually attracted to other men, and fear of other men being attracted to them. In other words, homophobia. Those fears in combination make it very, very difficult. It's an innate or learned, anyway, fear. And it makes it very, very difficult for men to love or more fully love and relate to all the people in their lives. So this is where I want to test your patriarchy quotient, PQ, so to speak. So I'm going to give you a couple of quotations, and I'll ask you to assess whether you think the speaker is man or woman. Okay, the first one, are you ready? The first one is, I think women are foolish to pretend they are equal to men. They are obviously superior. Let me make sure I got that right. Oh, they're far superior and always have been. I'm trying to downplay the extent of the superiority. So, was that a man or a woman who said that?
A man.
Who think it's a man? Yeah. Okay.
Ashley Montague.
Well, I have it as William Golding. Yeah. Lord of the Flies, and you know, I'm sure you do, Lord of the Flies, totally not really infantile, but a young, pre-pubertal group of men who couldn't take care of themselves, and in fact, ended up being deadly. Okay, this is going to be a more difficult one. Women are not happy with their husbands because they are not afraid of them. It is natural for women to be afraid when they love. If they don't want to be afraid, then perhaps they are becoming truly independent. And this society is producing a real new woman. Man or woman? Man, who says man? Who says woman? Okay. Let me, before I tell you which one it is, I'm going to go to a second quote by the same individual. Okay. Perhaps the American man isn't ready for real independence in women. He only wants to be the obedient son of his mother wife. There is now a great obligation laid upon the American people that the country shall face itself, that it shall admit its moment of tragedy in the present, admit that it has a great future only if it has courage to face itself. Man or woman, the same one, same individual.
Woman.
A woman. Everybody, the majority, who thinks it's a man? Yeah, the minority has it. It was Carl Jung. in 1912, on the occasion, either at one of the Fordham lectures or in conjunction with his activities when he was visiting the United States. So, yes, the last one? Oh, both of them, okay. Maybe you want to add some other comments as well, but I think it is interesting. I'm not saying Jung is a patriarch who fears women or anything else. I'm just reading what he said here. Okay. First one, women are not happy with their husbands because they are not afraid of them. It is natural for women to be afraid when they love. If they don't want to be afraid, then perhaps they are becoming truly independent, and this society is producing the real new woman. Second, perhaps the American man isn't ready for real independence in woman. He only wants to be the obedient son of his mother wife. There is now a great obligation laid upon the American people that the country shall face itself, that it shall admit its moment of tragedy in the present, admit that it has a great future, only if it has the courage to face itself. He was sort of prescient in a way I don't think he understood, obviously, that this election might be an appropriate object of those thoughts. We are at a crossroad. We are at a difficult point, and I don't think anybody in this room would be willing to bet a lot of money as to the outcome, because obviously the country is severely divided, and there are mostly men, but a lot of women who support those men, who support Donald Trump, and a lot of other women, and I hope more men than meets the eye, who support Hillary Clinton. We'll see. We'll see. Patriarchy. You could see I have difficulty staying on topic. Maybe for obvious reasons. It does hurt. So the derivation of patriarchy, we all know, comes from patria, the Latin. It's a word of feminine gender, interestingly. I find some irony there. And despite the Latin pater, which is masculine, of course, the father, it doesn't remove the feminine energy, the context in which patriarchy sits, at least from a Latin derivation. And it does remind me of the Greek tragedy stories in part, which I'll start now telling you, which I think provides some meaning and some context for this election. So I'm going to start with Mother Gaia and the firstborn creature from Mother Gaia, which was Uranus. of Uranus in the Roman spelling and pronunciation. So, Uranus, the heaven, the sky and rain god, was the first man, as I said, but the second-born creature. He was born parthenogenically from Gaia Mother Earth without male contribution, a far cry from Genesis, at least especially one of the particular Genesis creation stories. So together, incestuously, they produced a number of children. The most notable were the 12 Titans, among whom was the youngest, whom Hesiod calls Cunning Cronus. He hated his children, he feared them, it sounds familiar, and that hate and fear didn't bode well for his ability to be a father. So his defensive reaction when he had his children was to stuff them back into Mother Gaia, and there they were imprisoned until Mother Gaia, I guess, had enough. She was a little desperate, a little depressed. He had diminished her authority. She appeared powerless, unable to confront or have it out with her husband. So she hatched a plot, according to Hesiod. She fashioned an instrument of castration, a great metal scythe, and made her case to her children. "My children, you have a savage father. If you will listen to me, we may be able to take vengeance for his evil outrage. He was the one who started using violence." The children were gripped with fear. Not one of them spoke a word. They appeared stuck. But youngest Titan son, Cronos, great Cronos, took courage. He recognized the injustice enacted by his father and said, "Mother, I'm willing to carry through your plan." His decision to castrate, literally and metaphorically, disempower and delegitimize Father Uranus and release his volatile siblings was successful. His action constellated the first patricide and regicide. He indeed castrated his father. So together with Gaia, that was a mother or anima-inspired patriarchy. There was no other way to do it. Son Cronos' severance of Father Uranus' genitals, those essential components of masculinity, delayed the archetypal development of patriarch as wise old teacher. You know what I'm going to say next as to which candidate I'm going to identify Uranus with, right? Okay, so let me go ahead. The gendered man in this candidate, in this campaign, the candidate, Donald Trump. I see Cronos in Donald Trump. I look at the 15 or 16 original Republican candidates, excluding Carly Fiorina, of course, as collective representatives of the Republican Party father, the metaphorical establishment, smug in their political power, holders of a majority in both houses of Congress, unaware they were about to be emasculated by Cronos Trump. I changed his name. You may ask, where in Donald Trump's experience is the feminine energy that, in the form of women enablers of patriarchy? And I identify four here. I'm sure you could come up with any number. The first group of women who have enabled him and still enable him are the women, for example, who supported his 19-year operation of the Miss America and Miss Universe contests, including especially the mothers of the contestants, in my mind. Second, women politicians such as Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina, who continues to support Trump without qualification. Third, and I hope I don't offend anybody when I say this, traditional Christian women who adhere to St. Paul's message, "Submit yourselves to your husbands as you do to the Lord." I did say I was a recovering Catholic. And then women I don't quite understand. Women such as Katie Packer, a deputy campaign manager for Mitt Romney in 2012, who said a few days ago, speaking for a group named Next Generation Professional Women, these are professional, educated women, she says, the leaders of the Republican Party, make sure I get this straight, come November 9, the day after the election, better be prepared to make very strong statements condemning all of Trump's behavior. Why not now? Or before the election? Because he may win? They'll take him if he wins? As despicable as he may be? That's what it seems like. There is one other masculine energy from Greek mythology whom I think Trump embodies. Actually, not a god. I'm talking about Greek hero Tantalos. Let me read a little bit, and I'll maybe try to shorten this up a little bit, from Paul Kerenyi, who's the author of Gods of the Greeks and Heroes of the Greeks. He's my hero, my source for a lot of what I'm saying, you know, in terms of my view. In talking about Tantalos, is anybody familiar with Tantalos to begin with? Okay, now I could go on maybe longer than I otherwise might have. Kerenyi says about Tantalos, although a count of the man, he was no mortal. The everlasting duration of his punishment shows this. He suffered eternal inability, longing for food and drink, and inability to consummate that longing. And when I tell you the story, you'll understand why. So what I call the dysfunctional patriarchal dynasty started obviously with Uranus, Mother Gaia being his wife. It reached its patriarchal zenith in the generation succeeding Zeus, overall the fourth generation. So Uranus was the first generation, Cronus was the second, Zeus was the third, and Tantalos was the fourth because he was a son of Zeus. Tantalos' mother was Pluto, the rich, from whom the word plutocracy comes, a goddess, daughter of Cronos. Tantalos governed a kingdom that was famous from ancient times for its gold. His name has been assumed with talent as a measure of gold. Because of his wealth, he was able to befriend the Olympians, Zeus in particular. This friendship is an archetypal and cultural recognition of power and energy inherent in wealth. I'm going to try to contain myself, my populism, without getting on to Bernie Sanders at this point. So I think it's fairly clear. Wealth is a subset of patriarchal power, more so until last year. So back in mythological times, you know, a couple of thousand years B.C., wealth was certainly patriarchally determined. So Tantalos flaunted his wealth. He invited the gods to his home for a special feast without consulting available feminine wisdom, an example of men's undeveloped relatedness. Mother Pluto and wife Dione were absent from the scene, either by choice or by coercion. In either event, their absence represents a suppression or deficit of mothering instinct. Why? Perhaps as a survival strategy on their part, or perhaps in order to share or retain some share of political power that Tantalos, by virtue of his position and wealth, had. That theme of sharing power will come back again when we get to Hillary Clinton, which is just the way it is, unfortunate or fortunate, depending how much stock you put in that condition. So Karenyi describes the sacrificial feast in a scene that resonates with Tantalos's blind pride. Tantalos dared to set before them, this is the gods now, or this is on Olympus, he was able to be joining them there because of his special entree as well. He dared to set before them something which involved a much greater sin than the deceit of Prometheus, whereby Prometheus founded the great sacrificial animal ritual of the Greeks. Tantalos' sin was that he prepared for the gods no vicarious beast, but the best he had to give, his own son. He butchered little Pelops, cut him up, had his flesh cooked in a cauldron. The gods knew of it and refrained from eating, except from Mother Demeter, as it turned out, probably grieving from loss of her daughter Persephone at the time. That was the way Karenyi describes it. So he obviously had some model for devouring his progeny, and that was Uranus. It turns out Cronos himself, I guess it would be his grandfather, Zeus was his father, had similarly, when his children were born, ate them as they were born. And it was only Zeus whose mother, I guess it was Gaia and Rhea, gave Cronos an emetic in the form of a rock, caused the disgorging of all of his siblings. So Tantalus had some family devouring male energy to spur him on. As it turned out, great mother Rhea, I guess it was his grandmother, remembered and rebirthed the boy, who was apparently pre-pubertal at the time. So the boy is Pelops, who comes to play a greater share in Greek tragedy at a later point in time, which I forget whether I actually get into that or not. We'll find out. So, getting back to the current election, in my view, Donald Trump oozes with Tantalos energy. I don't have to convince you. With his pride, for example, and not having to pay federal income taxes for so many years. And I'm going to try to shortcut this and say the two ways in which he's able to avoid his income taxes are he relies on an accounting fiction, those of you who know any accounting, of depreciation, which is a non-cash expense, so there's never any money out of the pocket of the person who owns real estate, a building in particular. Land does not depreciate, presumably, according to accountants. And so as a result of a fictional cost or expense, with no money being expended, the person who owns real estate, in this case Donald Trump, has an expense as a result of which he pays less taxes, which as a result requires you and I to pay more taxes. But even worse than that, there is a phenomenon, and I'm not going to try to explain it very much, but I'll try to just put it into context. Has anybody ever heard of non-recourse loans? No real estate people? Yeah, there's one. Okay. So that means a loan in which the borrower is not responsible or obligated to pay back to the lender, in this case mostly a bank. And the reason the borrower is able to do that, first of all, he must have a lot of wealth himself, so he has an aura of respect, even though he's not putting his own money on the line. I said his money. It could be a woman, but I don't know of any in this context. I'm sure there are. And then the greater evil. So it's a ledger domain. It's a legal ledger domain in this case with a non-recourse loan. So not only does the borrower not have the obligation to pay back the loan, but if the borrower's project goes bankrupt, the borrower gets an opportunity to use the loss as if he did, as if he were obligated to pay back the loan. And not only that, he can use that loss from money which he didn't invest against real income, such as the beauty contest that Donald Trump ran for so many years. In my mind, that's a tragedy. We're coming to Bernie Sanders, which is much, much easier to take. In terms of time, am I doing okay? Oh, yeah. Okay. I have time. So, would anybody want to guess which of the gods Bernie Sanders may be incorporating in his life and practice and views? Yeah, it's kind of hard to guess. I do want to say, I think he named himself, and naming is so important, as we know from Genesis, in terms of setting a tone, setting a meaning and a purpose for one's life. He called himself Bernie, even though his name I believe is Bernard. I'm not absolutely sure of that. But just calling himself Bernie is kind of avuncular. I mean, he is a very warm, even though he's speaking, as a character, his speaking tone is not, I mean, he exhorts all the time. That's not very warm, but his name and his manner and his cause, obviously, is avuncular, more like a father than the fathers I've been talking about so far. So, at this point in Hesiod's and Karenji's genealogy of dysfunctional patriarchy dynasties, the repeated Anoranos, Kronos, Zeus, and Tantalos, men's power shadow, so to speak, has been the prime dynamism. The fears I mentioned. I have not considered the archetypal converse of the power that they exhibited to compensate for those fears, and that is love, relatedness. But Pelops' fate, he was the son whom Tantalos had butchered, served to the gods, grandmother Rhea remembered him, and at that point he was in need of help. It would be too much of an understatement to say he needed therapy. He needed deep, hands-on care, attention, nurturing, which up to this point no man, god, or goddess had exhibited in the Greek genealogy. You could say genealogy. I think it may have some historical. No, I'm just joking. I really don't know. In the instant of Pelops' rememberment and rebirth by Great Mother Rhea, that's Kronos' wife, Poseidon at once fell in love with Pelops and carried the beautiful boy off. He lifted him up on his chariot and brought him with his golden team to the palace of Zeus. So that, I believe, is Karenji. Some believe Poseidon's goal was pederasty. I don't buy it. I believe that view evidences homophobia. In my view, Poseidon images an emergency medical technician or emergency room doctor who responds to a field of trauma. The victim needs to be stabilized, then given life support, perhaps an intubation to restore breathing or defibrillation to start heart function. Death needs to be postponed. His life restored. Poseidon, in fact, in my mind, was nurturing father in the palace of Zeus, with archetypal hospital and sanitarium. As man god of the sea, from whose unconscious step the life, bios, started, Poseidon also images a protecting, nurturing, educating father. Kerenyi says of Poseidon, in his quality of father, for he could also simply be called pater, he came somewhere between the two sorts of male gods. Those on the one hand, who served, the great mother, and on the other, the Olympian father. In other words, Poseidon's balance of parental energies suggests a balancing, bridging third. He was a male god who had survived father-devouring energy of Titan father Cronus, and who could nurture son survivors. The ultimate question was, could Poseidon enact a combination of love and agency to reconstitute latent Pelops' psyche with sufficient ego strength to lead him toward realization of personal self after great mother Rhea had reconstituted his body? Poseidon essentially needed to be bivalent in assuming the role of father when little Pelops was in an early latent stage of sexual development, during which nurturing mother remained a significant need. My guess was, from the stories I've read, he was about 6 to 8 years old, prepubertal, clearly, in terms of psychosexual development. In my view, Poseidon's goal was child-focused, client-focused, if you will, and child-empowering, not archetypally self-serving. His goal was restoration of Pelops' psyche and trauma-shattered ego. Pelops needed replacement or substitute parents for his murderous father, Tantalos, and absent or abandoning mother, whose absence of Eros in each case he unconsciously mourned. Although Pelops experienced Poseidon's archetypal psychic restoration in a heavenly realm, in a, a spirit world, an archetypal world, a soul world, Poseidon didn't imprison him there, unlike Zeus did and with other young men. But Poseidon returned Pelops to Earth, embodied in the material world of humans with a chance to live life. He eventually sat on his father's throne. In summary, Poseidon fathered Pelops in a way that might be considered more than good enough. A man who stayed at home, in a way, a stay-at-home dad, and parented as a primary task, role, goal, and identity. You're not going to be surprised to hear me say, in my view, Bernie Sanders has demonstrated a renewal of Poseidon father energy. He has made a case for restoring hope and ideals to our young people, the metaphorical Pelops of our country, and they have obviously responded, and some of us old people have responded as well. So I've talked about Bernie and Poseidon and Donald Trump and Uranus and Tantalos. There's only one candidate left, right? I need to talk about or. You don't need to listen if you don't want to listen about Hillary Clinton, because I do find it difficult to talk what most people, I guess, excluding her most avid supporters, who feel she has an ambivalence of choices of perhaps of, I don't want to say character, habits, I guess, maybe, which make some of the things, choices she has made questionable, at least able to be commented upon in a negative way. So, I liken her first to Athena, a favorable comparison. Does everybody know how, I think everybody must know how Athena was born from the head of Zeus. I don't need to get into that detail.
You should.
I should. Okay. I was taking your shaking of your head as being reflective of the whole group of us here, but I guess, okay. So, in my view, Zeus had commenced political patriarchy, utilizing a masculine adaptation of Eros energy to establish stable order and commerce. You might call it crony capitalism. Make no mistake, however, his reign was not based on consensus or democracy or commitment to polis, to community. Zeus married his first wife, Titan Metis, goddess of wisdom, in consolidation of his military victory over Titan father Cronos and the other Titans. So he brought a Titan into his home. So the marriage was a model for later patriarchal rulers. It bridged Titanic and Olympian cultures, showed his political acumen, and commenced his self-serving relatedness. When grandfather Uranus and grandmother Gaia advised Zeus that Metis was carrying an extraordinary child, that about to be a born Athena would be his equal in strength and in wise understanding, it was an eternal moment for Zeus. I define that moment to mean the narrow time frame in which potential for history to be made or to be birthed or to be directionally launched or to be changed from its axis is pregnant and possible. Well, I guess maybe it's pregnant with possibility. With courage, Zeus might have instigated an epiphany of relational eros beyond boy Cupid and mother Aphrodite, and commenced a political system in which consensus of masculine and feminine was the rule. You also should know here, I just want to say parenthetically, that originally, under Hesiod's story, Eros was not personified, was not individualized. Eros was simply an energy that pre-existed Gaia, actually. No, she's third. I'm sorry. I misspoke. I might have seen you nod your head there to correct me on that. But anyway, Eros was relatedness in terms of energy. And Aphrodite, after Uranus' genitals were tossed into the ocean, it was only then that Aphrodite, sexual Eros, was born and dominated male psyche, male energy, from that point on. So I'm talking about going back to a pre-castration of Cronos' time when Eros ruled in a way, and not ruled, but was available, because it was there, relatedness was there, and everything. It was disconnecting energy. Where am I? So if Zeus had recognized the potential for a consensus, there might have been a heavenly marriage, Eros, Thamos, in Jung's words, in one of his favorite terms. His sacrifice of authority would have expanded father's commitment to community based on compassion and wisdom. It would have been an individuating decision. Yet, it didn't turn out that way. Zeus remained enthralled in man's power shadow, its dominating filicidal field. He repeated his father and grandfather's effort, I guess more specifically, Cronos' effort. He ate pregnant Metis whole. And his swallowing of Metis was an attempt, I guess you might say metaphorically, to gain feminine strength and wisdom. But it failed utterly, as we know, because Athena birthed, whether it's with or without Hephaestus' help, from Zeus's head. So in my view, I'm not the only one who has this view, Athena's head birthing was irrefutable, unchangeable, metaphorical recognition of women's bivalent nature as mother, non-mother, other than mother, that cannot be repressed. In James Hillman's view, Athena represents institutional mother. She never is seen carrying a child or being with children. But she is sort of the template for the polis to function in all its traditions and rules and law in politics. She is the, did I say matrix? Am I repeating myself? For that energy to go forward. Now, she also has another side. Athena not only has that institutional side, as we know from the Iliad, she is able to be, I wouldn't say enabler, but she takes sides and takes a side with some righteousness or some sense of justice or divine justice, maybe, if you will. So she, in addition to being an institutional mother, so to speak, was also a warrior, and not simply a warrior in the trenches, but a general who could see the big picture, who could direct the Achaeans, the Greeks in the field, which is what she did. And there were two notable battles in the Iliad, and I may be conflating them a little, in which she personally confronts war god Ares. In the one, she jumps in the chariot with Greek warrior Diomedes, a man who is told by Homer to be very small in stature, like his father, and on the surface not much of a warrior, but whose energy and strength was magnificent. And she directs him against Ares, who at this point just had, in the absence of Achilles, gathered the Trojans to a point that they were about to be victorious. So Athena steps into the battle on the side of a small man in terms of physical stature, but a great man in terms of strength and courage. And she directs his spear, Diomedes' spear, directly after, I'm sorry, Ares first makes an attempt to spear Diomedes. She deflects it. I think at this point she's invisible. So in this first context, she's not showing herself fully to her brother. Ares doesn't know it is she who was in the chariot with Diomedes. So she deflects Ares' spear. She in turn directs Diomedes' spear toward Ares, injures him significantly in the midsection, and he cries a great cry. He's thrown out of his chariot, and kind of like a bully, which in some ways you might say men who make war are, runs up to Father Zeus and complains that this mortal, who realizes it was aided by Athena, had bested him on the battlefield. You might think that would be enough to establish the energy of Athena, but there was one other story later on in the 10-day period in which Athena decides directly to confront Ares in a battle. A number of gods at this point are actually on the field identified, and she wants to confront directly areas without being invisible this time. So I'm not sure. You don't quote me on the detail. He throws a spear, which somehow she avoids again. She picks up a boundary boulder, very meaningful, I think, and tosses this giant boundary boulder at Ares in the field, hits him in the neck, and he is knocked over again. He retires again to Father Zeus, complains, I think, about that Zeus can't control his daughter. But she establishes her courage, her force. But in terms of boundaries, the image of a boundary stone, and somehow even wars have boundaries, unless we, you know, we've reached the point where we totally disintegrate ourselves with atomic weapons. Homo couldn't imagine our current science. So the sense that even war could be limited, I think, comes from Athena. So I could say that I do say, I think Hillary Clinton evidences Athena energy. She's fearless. If you've seen, I'm sure all of you have seen the debates. Donald Trump did not really affect her composure, her strength, her position, and everything she said, even when he was stalking her, if you remember, I think in the second debate, an utterly fearless woman. So I think she very readily reflects Athena, and especially there was one time, I think it was the second debate, during which Trump was talking, yeah, that was the town hall debate, and Trump was talking to the gathering of people who were in on stage with him. And I think there was a question asked about the wall, the wall between U.S. and Mexico, that we know Trump has touted all these months. And he made some comment about the wall, and Hillary quipped behind him. What was it she said? I wrote it down. She said, when you were talking to the Mexican president, you choked, Donald. You choked. You didn't tell him that he would need to pay for the wall, which is a fact, as we mentioned. In that moment, she was Athena with a boundary stone and knocked him flat and made her point as being, well, enough. Even he recognized her, that she's a tough, tough person. That's the positive side of Hillary Clinton. Maybe I should stop before I get to the negative. I guess you're not going to let me help. We have time.
We have plenty of time.
Yeah, I'm trying to get off this.
We have
to
9 o'clock.
Oh, I know that. I want to go for a question and answer. And I'm hoping anybody in the audience can have answers to any questions that may be asked. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I don't have it. I'm also aware that on Athena's shield,
yes,
is the head of Medusa.
Yes. I have a sense of that. What's your view of that?
Well, Medusa's power is to turn people to stone.
Yes.
So
yes.
She just stops a lot.
But it's a she. It's a feminine energy, Medusa.
Yeah.
Medusa.
And she was. I forget which goddess she offended.
Aphrodite?
Yeah.
Oh, right, Aphrodite.
Okay.
And she was very beautiful, and she offended Aphrodite by her beauty and was turned into Medusa.
She's a coalescence of feminine energy that turns into, I would say, compensatingly, just absolutely fierce, uncontained, unable to be restrained, refusal to accept a masculine position. And there's something archetypal about that. A woman who has been scorned can be considered to be reflective of. Yeah, thanks, Erica. Okay, so we're back to the maybe shadow side, maybe not so shadow side of Hillary Clinton, and I look at this part of her as Jocasta energy, meaning that she's reflecting a side of women, understandably, compensatingly want to attain, retain, be part of political power. They want to have a say. You could look at her marriage to Bill Clinton that way. You could look at her support of him during the impeachment hearings that way. You could look at her in this one additional way, which I'm going to refer to now. And by that I mean with respect to what Bill Clinton did. In my mind, he was the source of this latest release of Wikipedia emails that turned out to be on Anthony Weiner's computer. And the reason James Comey was able to do what he did as director of the FBI and not pass it by and have the approval of his bosses, his supervisors in the Justice Department, namely Loretta Lynch, was because Bill Clinton, you may remember, met with Loretta Lynch back in August on a tarmac in, I think it was Atlanta. And that essentially, wrong word, is emasculation, depotentiated Loretta Lynch at that time. She didn't know it, nobody knew it, but at that time, Comey, by virtue of what appeared to maybe be a conflict of interest, was able to do what he ultimately did. So the conflict of interest, just to make it absolutely clear, would be that if there was a dispute about the election, as it was with Al Gore and George Bush, the FBI, not the FBI, Loretta Lynch and the Justice Department would be defending the case or making the case on behalf of the legality of the election, presumably, in the Supreme Court. That's where the case would be tried. So you have to say at least the appearance of a conflict of interest was instigated by Bill Clinton. I don't want to tell you any more about what I think about Bill Clinton, but she was stuck at that point, like, you know, this time more so. I mean, when Bill Clinton was impeached and then there was the conviction hearing, it's understandable why she was stand by her husband. You might even say it was an Athena-like move to stand by her husband at that time. The country's political ability to govern itself was at risk if there was an actual conviction. The Constitution provides for a choice to be made of the next person to go up the hierarchy or down the hierarchy chain. That would have been, I forget who was his vice president at that time. So there was an institutional way to pass power, but it would have been a total change of the country's accomplishments. And I think one of the things he did after that was to pass welfare reform, for one example. So she supported him there. And she had a choice and she took it. In this case now, he took from her hands any choice that she might have had to say to him, Bill, don't make an ass of yourself and talk with Loretta Lynch or anybody else without consulting me. He didn't do it. He didn't do it. So I look at Bill Clinton. I don't want to get too far into this. It's kind of a... Eliab's character. This is really complicated. Let me just read what I wrote and see if I want to continue with this. I guess I do. In this way, let me tell you why. The current emails that have been talked about but not disclosed are Hillary Clinton's emails that were found on the server of Anthony Weiner, who's under investigation by the FBI for sending sex messages of some kind across state lines by definition with the internet. Well, it could have been in New York, but it was across state lines. Young woman, out of state, federal offense. I think everybody knows who Anthony Weiner is, right? Former New York. Is that? No, that's something else. Okay. It's not a comment on texting. So he's a former New York congressman whose wife is Huma Abedin, Hillary Clinton's first aide confidant for, I don't know how many years, maybe 15, 20 years, since before she was, I think she became an aide for Clinton while Bill Clinton was president. So the sexting nature of these, somehow the potential emails that got mixed up with Hillary's official emails that were on, at least initially, on Huma Abedin's computer that ended up on her husband Anthony Weiner's computer, ends up, in my mind, injecting a sense of illicit sex, pathological sex, into the campaign in a way that can't be denied, unfortunately. And not that anybody in the campaign itself is involved, but it's a Lyos-like move, in my mind, in the sense that Bill Clinton himself, we know, was only impeached in the first place because of a, you might say, pathological sex, or you could say sexual compulsion, in an act which today, if he were president, he clearly would be guilty of sexual abuse, even though Monica Lewinsky at the time was 22 years old. Clearly, he was superior in power. There's no doubt, in my mind anyway, he would have been convicted in today's climate, in today's awareness of the sexual mores and the harm, the pathology that it's part of. So, in that sense, you may remember Lyos had raped Pellet's son, Chrysippus, after what might be considered 10 or 15 years of being a friend and actually having Pelops as a godfather, so to speak, for Lyos. So Lyos and Pelops had this very, very close relationship for 10 or 15 years. Lyos had been taken from the neighboring kingdom when he was an infant. So essentially, Pelops raised Lyos at the same time he was raising his son, Chrysippus. And unfortunately, Lyos at some point in time was overcome with sexual desire. And while on a lesson teaching Chrysippus how to ride the chariot, ended up raping Chrysippus, for which Pelops was cursed, or cursed Lyos. Pelops curses Lyos, one of the gods, I think Apollo, maybe Hera, also cursed Lyos. And that in some ways was a commencement of homophobia that wasn't even a word in Greek society, as I did my best to research at one time. So it's that kind of indiscretion that I would say Bill Clinton evidence and Hillary Clinton is subject to live with. And that's just very unfortunate. That's where I'm going to stop. That's where I'm going to stop. The silence is resounding. Yeah.
Did you
mean
by Joe
Cassa
energy?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'll get to you a second. The Joe Cassa energy, I look at it as a desire to share power. So after Oedipus slew her husband, and after Oedipus had answered the Sphinx's question, she married Oedipus, we know, who became his wife as well as her son. They had four children. A support for my position that she wanted to maintain power as much as the, maybe more than being mother, was, according to the Aeschylus play, Seven Against Thebes, when her two sons were unable to follow Father Oedipus' directions to share the kingdom, but he decided to leave when he became aware of who Jocasta was and with whom he had fathered his children. He had fathered his children. They face, it's a scene in Seven Against Thebes in which her two sons are on the battlefield facing each other, and she's watching. She's watching, and that's all she does. She does not try to intervene. They end up, in a very short order, mortally wounding each other. They die. She ends up then sharing the kingdom, ruling the kingdom with brother Creon. Creon, her brother, was there before Oedipus came on the scene, came back on the scene when Oedipus left, and when the two sons began to war. So I'm saying Jocasta energy is looking out for herself and looking for an opportunity to wield power. Understandably, maybe, but also maybe not. Yeah, back there, there was one question.
That was my question also.
Same question?
You just addressed it.
Oh, okay. Wow, is it all that clear or all that terrible? Thank
you. Can I use your mic?
Yes,
go ahead. First, Richard, I want to thank you for giving our present agonies an archetypal perspective. Because I suspect many of you, like me, have a level of concern and anxiety in the pit of your stomachs about next Tuesday evening. And I want to tell you why I have it. This is not from an archetypal perspective. This is from a clinical perspective. Depth psychological, psychodynamic perspective. With Donald Trump, and I may offend some of you if you're Trump believers, but you need to hear this at least so you know what you're getting. It's been said in the Gazette, it's been said in the New York Times, but it doesn't seem to register with so many Republican politicians who keep saying, well, he's going to turn a corner, he's going to change, he's going to become presidential. Diagnostically, he is a severe narcissistic personality disorder. That's who he is. And to add to that, he's got very real psychopathic tendencies and orientation. And that's what we're going to get in the Oval Office on Wednesday if he wins. And two of the most difficult conditions in mental illness that is non-psychotic but is severe are severe narcissism and psychopathy. And severe narcissism is rooted usually in a deep early inner wound. I can't help wondering why we don't hear about his mother. Total patriarchal family system. No sense of whether he was mirrored, nourished, empathically responded to by a maternal figure that I think would have made an enormous difference. So that's briefly the issue. If he were willing to go and see me for 3 times a week for 5 years, we might turn a corner. I don't have the feeling that's an option.
Maybe 20 years.
20 years. The second thing is psychopathy. And there's been some very interesting Jungian books written on this. It's a big subject. I'm going to try to give you a very quick description of what these books say. It's a terribly wounded feeling function. It's a feeling function that's been damaged deeply early, so that there's not feeling relatedness. There's not the capacity to feel empathy. And that leads to the only alternative is to try to say whatever will please this person and then that person, etc. That is psychopathy. And he's carrying both of these damaged conditions, and he is he's charismatic, he's an effective entertainer, and behind that is an unconscious, dangerous fascist mentality. I spent time at Nuremberg. I liberated a concentration camp. I have seen the worst of that, what that pathology can do. And so I share that with you because I feel it's relevant from the clinical perspective as it is relevant from the mythological archetypal perspective.
Yeah, first you and then you. Okay,
Richard, would you say that Poseidon and Athena will get along and help each other out?
Their energies, at least to the extent that Poseidon is in the manifestation or the energy of father that I talked about, yes, by all means. I mean, fathering right now, especially, needs reconstituting. Men generally, they're the ones who have lost the greater portion of jobs that have been sent overseas in coal and steel, for example. So if they had some Poseidon nurturing, as he was able, at least has been able to try to describe it with the young Pelops, Athena would be an aid to him, I think, to the energy that we need more than a nurturing mother at this point. But a mother with an authority in a collective sense. And that's why I say she's an institutional mother. So I think in a collective sense, she would work very well.
Do you think that she would permit that, though?
Permitted?
Yeah, like she would welcome. I mean, if she is, the goddess of wisdom and carries this energy of battle, and not goddess of war, but at least
you read about. She's formidable on the battlefield. Is she open to being fathered by, and I speak about this as a, you know, woman in, you know, 2016, you know, it takes a certain amount of softening and receptivity to say, I could learn from the masculine. I could be his father in a healthy way.
I don't think, if you look at the gods as being, you know, just archetypal energy and not as individuals, that she needs a compensation in that way. She doesn't need to overcome any injury, any vulnerability that she has. That energy is complete. So she's not threatened by Aries, obviously, and she wouldn't be threatened by Poseidon. They're equals on Olympus. That's my take.
In observing this whole political race, I have never seen such cruelty in my time. Every word that comes out of his mouth is an attack, and in all the debates, every time he's been asked questions, he doesn't really give answers. I have a fear in the pit of my stomach, and I was listening to MSNBC last night. It was actually in tears. I thought, he's doing whatever he can to destroy her. The destroyer is threatening her life. And some of the things he's saying, some of the things I'm hearing other people say, they would be in jail.
Yeah.
But these people are getting away with it. This has got to stop.
Thank you.
You said it. I'm not going to disagree with it. I totally agree. Yes.
Well, thank you. Really appreciate your sharing your thoughts. It seems to me that there's one aspect of this that is really critical for our understanding of how and why the political process has proceeded as it has, and that's the response of the American public. And I'm wondering how you would characterize the psyche of the public, which would find much of what you're saying first incomprehensible, but then at best for them a strange allegory. But how would you describe the affinity, the attraction, the appeal that this has in terms of a collective psychopathy, perhaps? How are we? It's got to be a relational understanding. I mean, it's not this triumvirate at the top working it out amongst themselves. This is a broad cultural, social process across the American public. How do we bring that dimension into this kind of an understanding? And how would you describe the receptivity of people to this kind of a figure, in the Trump figure?
You very well expressed the facts on the ground, so to speak, among these men in particular. There was I can't remember the name of the book, a man recently, may still be on the New York Times bestseller list, who lived in Appalachia. I think he may have become a lawyer.
Hillbilly elegy.
Yeah. Yes, that's what it was. Which elegy?
Hillbilly
elegy, yeah, if you want to get a sense of who these people are. They're men, essentially, who feel like they've been emasculated. They have gone from a position of not authority as such, but comfort, I guess. They've had unions, which have been powerful, which also, by virtue of the need for coal and some people's desire to have coal no longer mined, I mean, that's substitute energy, has put coal essentially out of business. And Hillary Clinton, you may remember, made an offhand and unintentional remark. Wasn't her undesirable remark, but it was essentially, we don't need coal anymore, and there's still a lot of men working in the coal mine. So they have gone from know, upper middle class and position on the power ladder to down to the bottom. And in some cases, they feel have gone down farther than people who have been at the lowest rung of that ladder, such as blacks and immigrants, many immigrants who take entry level jobs or jobs like Mexican migrants picking fruit. So these men, how you approach these men, I don't know. I don't know if anybody knows. Putting them to work would be a big help. And one way to do that, both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have proposed to have a whole new infrastructure program, including as part of infrastructure, for example, the internet. And I don't know what percentage of our country, I'm guessing 20 or 30% of it is not hooked up and doesn't have access to the internet. India, for example, I'm told, I think has almost 100% internet access. We have to recognize their pain, easy to say, but realistically recognize it by giving them jobs. And you don't need to train for those jobs. I'm not saying all of them would fit automatically in bridge and highway and airport construction. I mean, some of them can be trained as basic computer people, but they have to be given some sense that they're part of people's caring, and maybe then they'll give up their whining. No, it's not whining. Don't quote me that way. No, don't. Their sense of being victims, which is what they clearly feel they are right now. Yeah.
Would it be simplistic to suggest that Trump's appeal lies in his embodying of shadow energy?
I think what we have been talking about have been our shadow energies. These men don't evidence, they don't speak out loud the pain they're speaking. They want to be made part of the greatness where they were. But that's their shadow, is their inability, or it reflects their inability to show their pain, and they're being put down as much as they feel. So they're dangerous in that sense. It's, in a sense, that energy is unconscious in them. Yeah.
Piggybacking on that shadow aspect, I wonder if Trump's popularity is a shadow reaction, a collective shadow reaction to Obama becoming president.
Yes.
And that it's like a pendulum that swings, and it's, I remember feeling so much hope when Obama became president and he campaigned on hope, and feeling that there was hope, and I'm not feeling that now. It feels like it shriveled up.
Yeah, right on, Dan. The combination of Barack Obama, even though hasn't literally translated to any great number percentage of blacks being elevated to a higher economic position politically, that's an image of a successful black who presumably was going to raise everybody's position. But, and even though he has a great deal of popularity now, more than he's had throughout his 8 years, still he's looked at, he's powerless to have a Supreme Court vacancy filled. So they still, that's the whole purpose of that. My view, the reason why Congress, especially the Republicans in the Senate, refused to allow a hearing for his nominee, because the man is black. That's the one, again, with power. That's my view.
Yeah. I think, coming sort of back to Jung, Jung at one point, when he was very depressed about the world, he said the only hope is in democracy. What he meant by that was that the shadow could be expressed. And I think that's what's happening with Bernie and with Trump. is the two shadow elements that have been boiling up and been gathering energy for years and years and years have finally broken through, which to me is hopeful. Because I don't think the Bernie people, I mean, somebody, I forget who it was, but there was a call-in thing on our local radio station, and somebody was saying, oh, I think Bernie should become the head of the Senate. And the person, the moderator who was very knowledgeable said, no, I think Chuck Schumer should do that because he's good at doing that. Bernie should become the head of three very powerful committees because he wants to write legislation. And he is the most powerful person in Washington right now. And we need him to do that. And so I think these two, and I think the very, very right wing has been smoldering and smoldering and gathering power, and it's just popped. So I feel like there's, at least it's out in the open, where people are making conscious decisions about it, hopefully for sanity, not insanity. But and I think Hillary is sort of the, I like the idea of her slinging the spear to Aries. Because Aries is the god of war. And she sides with the small man.
Yes.
Who has tremendous energy, but not stature. And I think hopefully she and Bernie can, you know, he's going to stand up for her. He's not going to stop.
No, he has his own constituency now to a certain extent. Yeah, and I think that's a wonderful statement of hope. Now, just the, I'm not disagreeing with you. I just want to quote to give balance. A balancing of that hope is the recognition of what Winston Churchill said, I believe, of democracy. I'm not sure you're thinking the same thing. Somebody said, it may have been Winston Churchill, I thought it was Tocqueville, that democracy is the worst kind of government except for all others. I'm thinking of the additional.
I think it was good.
Well, Churchill also said, the best argument against democracy is a 5-minute conversation with the average voter. Now, we have to be realistic and not take it for granted that what has been added in terms of shadow is going to succeed in a way that we find is livable. Yeah?
It's following on that thought, as Bill also said, that we have a great future to really feel that. So, if we can face ourselves, I'm wondering if the shadow is, if we don't allow ourselves to fail, when you're talking about the men, that they can't express their pain. I know so many, especially men, who never ever can say they're sorry. I think this is like a shadow thing that they can't say it. And so when everything is about a win-lose, like even the debates are about win-lose, that's not a discussion. That's not being heard. During a discussion, you heard no one's winning or losing. It's transcends the win and lose part. And I'm just looking at narcissism, or that these things are disconnection. You are no longer in relationship. And that there's a way of, that's where the wound is. They cannot find a way to admit a failing. Say, here is the pain. And I'm just wondering, because there's, when you say that there's no hope right now, but we just came through the Bernie phenomenon, which was a miracle, I think. And it just happened, and it could easily not have happened. And what it is what, to me, it wasn't Bernie. It was people trying to say that it's us, and that usness is a connected quality. That when we're looking at pathological narcissist this close to the presidency, it's a sign of how disconnected we become from ourselves.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, there's hope to see that and to say, how do we connect? And how do we connect through our weakness and through our ways of lose, the way that we are not the greatest?
What, that last sentence, not what?
Let's connect on how we're not the greatest.
Yes, yes, yes. The greatest is an expression of an inner weakness, a fear. We don't need to be great if we're comfortable. I mean, we don't need to feel great. We need to be who we are, which has elements of greatness in it, all of us. So you're expressing a desire and a goal of relatedness that I totally agree with, and at least we in this room maybe can feel that and run with it. It's possible. I mean, and Bernie, whether he's the president of the Senate or it turns out to be chair of three powerful committees, is certainly going to carry that energy on. Yeah. Assuming that Hillary is elected. Yeah.
Well, they'll carry it on anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
I just had some. I was a Bernie supporter, so I just had some different. I disagree with a lot, not a lot, but some of what you say, because it reminds me when LBJ ran against Goldwater, he was a peace candidate in '64. In '65, he ordered an invasion, a U.S. invasion of Indochina, and 15 years later, there were 4 million Vietnamese dead. 40 Vietnamese died for every one American. 2 million Cambodians died. I think Hillary's going to win, I hope. But she has a record of supporting the criminal invasion of Iraq. She supported the overthrow of the Libyan government. She supports a no-fly zone in Syria, which is very dangerous. You could have a nuclear power, Russia and U.S. shooting each other's planes now. And she supported the surge in Afghanistan, a 15-year-old war, in a country that provides 95% of the world's heroin. And when the Taliban in power, they were psychotic killers, but their heroin export was zero. And lastly, is I'm just afraid we're going to this new Cold War with Russia. Is what frightens me, because I'm just a student of history. I love history. It reminds me of the Balkans before World War I. a small conflict that big powers are invested in that can spiral way out of control. And I thought ISIS was totally financed by Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, the Gulf States. And we just sold $150 billion of armaments to Saudi Arabia in the last 3 years. So there's a lot of, I don't know. I hope Hillary wins, but I think the left and the peace group and Bernie should hold their feet to the fire, because you can be right-wing, like obviously right-wing, but you can be neoliberal and have the same invasion and the same, I mean, my last statement, In Syria is and Afghanistan now, especially Iraq, there's 10 million refugees as a result of this invasion. 1 million dead, probably 300,000 to 1 million have died. And talking about shadow, we need to look at our own shadow, what we have caused in the Middle East. We attacked Iraq with no justification. They had nuclear weapons. It was bogus. So I know I'm pontificating, but I have to get it off my chest.
You did. You want to answer it, and I'll let you go.
Not answer it. It just emotionally moved me greatly. I don't know the Jungian terminology, but Eckhart Tolle would talk about a conglomerate pain body. Mm-hmm. In our country's conglomerate pain body has become enormous. Mm-hmm. And to do things like Iraq and Afghanistan and learn nothing from Vietnam, and to continue to sell weapons, promote war, and not see that part of all these candidates just about this.
Yeah, I do. Let me just comment briefly, and then I'm not sure. It looks like around 5 minutes.
Can you respond to my comment?
Well, I think when I respond to him, I think it'll cover yours as well. Clearly, Hillary, you say you're voting for Hillary, is the only candidate, I think, who can be restrained enough to make a case for a thoughtful investigation of what our alternatives are, for example, with the Middle East. And I don't know if as part of that process, you know, with her inner group of people, the generals, whether she'll come to an examination of, for example, especially to begin with, I think Vietnam is too far gone right now to go back and have a war crimes tribunal for Vietnam, but it's not too far back to have a war crimes tribunal for our invasion of Iraq.
Or of a grave.
that would be an easy way, more limited goals. To give a sense of divine justice and be able to account for the mistakes we made and then be better able to confront the Russians, which at some point I think are going to have to be confronted. I have no knowledge of, you know, what is actually going on with the Russians. I just don't like the fact, which is fairly clear, I think, that Donald Trump has some sort of relationship with Putin and with the Russians, which is not objective. I mean, coming out of a mentality as Thayer just described a few minutes ago, there's no way he can be objective, and there's no way he can be effective in dealing with anybody, never mind the Russians. So, you know, just focusing on some sense of divine justice and recognizing our mistakes, starting with the invasion of Iraq, I think we'd go a long way to reestablish our sense of our ability to be fair and to work for a consensus among nations. One more question? Yeah, go ahead.
I have two thoughts. One, what I've been hearing just recently is an idealistic, I wish it were so, kind of orientation to our political and international situation. I basically have, unfortunately, a rather tragic sense of the world and our future. The issue of the shadow, I did my PhD on the individual and the collective shadow, and you see in Germany particularly how projecting onto a leader what one cannot acknowledge within oneself and face responsibility for creates the power of a fascist regime. And that's in a smaller, hopefully less dangerous situation, what I feel so many of the Trump supporters are doing. They are disempowered. They are disillusioned. They have been cheated. And all of that is valid for them. But Trump represents the projection of power shadow. And he's not going to fulfill it for them if he were to win. The thing that I learned basically from Reinhold Niebuhr when I went through Union Theological Seminary, and he had to go from being a pacifist to supporting the war that I fought in, and the issue is the lesser evil is in fact the greater good, and we have to realize that there is no such thing as purity. We can't expect that, and if we get sucked into it, we're in danger, because in a certain way that I feel is what's supporting Trump. And if he has access to the nuclear code, given his pathology, you're not going to have any living grandchildren.
Okay, yes. Okay, two more questions. We have 2 minutes.
Do you have an archetype, and this is kind of follow up with the archetype about there's no such thing as purity? Do you have an archetype to suggest for Jill Stein?
For Jill Stein? Oh, gosh. No, I would ask for help on that one. I mean, the fact that she is a woman and doing what she's doing certainly supports an Athena kind of energy. And in effect, I think supports Hillary Clinton and all women generally in terms of any glass ceiling, because as they're saying, the ceiling is mostly political now the ability for women to take part in power sharing. So I have no specific, beyond that suggestion. There was one more question, yes.
Could you see any use in the book's work that you're doing with this? Of the whole Iphigenia or Agamemnon, Hymenestra, all that whole story where there's the sacrifice of Iphigenia to get the thought of both movies across the where they are, and then he gets back, right?
I'm not sure I'm hearing your question.
After having sacrificed the daughter, and then Hymenestra, his wife, murders him in his tub because
expresses two opposing views, and ultimately a third function comes out of it. But the energies, I guess you're talking about, are the masculine and feminine, definitely energies that end up being subject to some sort of sense of divine justice. I think it's hard for me to look at those individual stories, in particular Clytemnestra, and come up with a collective energy that relates to what we're talking about tonight. I'm sorry I couldn't be more specific. Yeah, it is 9 o'clock. We are going to set boundaries, and I'm going to take Athena's rock and hold it right here just to indicate that the time has come for the end of the session. Thank you all.